Although it seems unprecedented for the government to force Americans to buy a particular service or product, there are many examples of government compelling its citizens to behave in certain ways for their own health and safety. The law requiring drivers to wear seatbelts is just one example. Whatever one may think about the merits of the individual mandate, the issue has been decided for us by the highest judicial body in the land, which sidestepped all of the complicated arguments for and against it. The Supreme Court ruled in June 2012 that the mandate was simply another tax, and thus constitutional under the federal government's long-established power to tax Americans. It was a controversial ruling, especially since the word tax is not found in the language of the law itself, and because the Obama administration denied that the individual mandate was a tax, calling it a penalty. As much as we may scratch our heads over these odd aspects of the court's ruling, the bottom line is that the individual mandate is here to stay. Only an amendment to the Constitution could strike it down now, and that is highly unlikely. Penalties for not obtaining health insurance. If you're worried about being criminally prosecuted and put in jail for not getting health insurance under Obamacare, don't be. The law specifically states that this will not happen. It also says that the government cannot put a lien on your property as a means to pressure you to obtain health insurance if you adamantly refuse to do so. The law, however, does empower the Internal Revenue Service to seize tax refunds as payment toward an unpaid penalty. This power is significant, as almost half of all income tax returns processed by the IRS result in a refund to the taxpayer. The average refund in 2011 was about $2,700, which means that in most cases, it will be big enough to pay the individual mandate penalty. About half of all taxpayers will therefore be in danger of the IRS seizing their income tax return if they don't comply with the individual mandate. But all Americans could be menaced in another way. The IRS is free to write intimidating letters, threatening jail and large financial penalties for non-compliance to any citizen, regardless of whether they receive an income tax refund or not. This power should not be underestimated, as many fear the IRS almost as much as the Grim Reaper. As Elizabeth Maresca of the Tax and Consumer Litigation Clinic put it, most people pay because they're scared, and I don't think that's going to change. How much will the fine be if you do in fact have to pay it? The amount will vary depending on the year it's incurred. The individual mandate takes effect in 2014, and if you don't obtain health insurance that year, you will have to pay either a flat fee of $95 or 1% of your income up to a maximum of $285. The amount of the fine is capped at triple the flat fee. You'll have to pay whichever amount is higher in your case. After that, the penalty will grow until it reaches a ceiling in 2016, a flat fee of $695 or 2.5% of your income up to a maximum of $2,085. As in previous years, you will have to pay whichever amount is higher for you. Who will be hurt most by the individual mandate? Keep in mind that only a small fraction of Americans will have to worry about the individual mandate and the financial penalty that comes with it. If you already have health insurance, that's 84 of every 100 of us, you won't have to pay any penalty, since your existing coverage means that you comply with the law. Of the 46 million who were uninsured in 2011, not counting 13 million illegal aliens, about one-third will be able to obtain health care coverage without paying anything out of their own pocket by enrolling in Medicaid after its expansion. This group of people can avoid the penalty by simply signing their name on a piece of paper. Another 14 million currently uninsured Americans will be able to receive government financial assistance when they buy coverage through their state's exchange. With this help, it will probably be less expensive for many in this group to buy subsidized insurance than to pay the fine. The remaining group of uninsured, about 9 million Americans or 3% of the population in 2010, will also be able to buy coverage through the exchanges, but they will have to do so without a subsidy. This is the group of Americans with the greatest financial incentive to refuse to comply with the individual mandate. Although this is only a sliver of the total population, in absolute terms, 9 million is not a small number of people. While the coercive aspect of the individual mandate ruffles the sensibilities of many Americans who feel an oppressive government breathing down their necks, the pain of its imposition is lessened considerably by the expansion of Medicaid and the subsidized healthcare exchanges. There are also select groups of people who will be exempt from any financial penalties if they do not get health insurance. These include those who can prove a financial hardship, that is, the lowest cost plan they could obtain through their state's exchange is greater than 8% of their income. Those who have an income below the tax filing threshold, $9,350 for individuals and $18,700 for joint filers in 2010. Native Americans, who receive health insurance in a separate government program. Those who have been without health insurance for only a brief time, 3 months or less. The prison population. Those with religious objections. Illegal immigrants. They will not be subject to a financial penalty because they don't have health insurance, nor will they be able to buy health insurance on the exchanges. It should be noted that young adults up to the age of 26 can also escape the individual mandate penalty by remaining a dependent covered by their parents' health insurance. This provision of Obamacare took effect in September 2010. Young adults under age 30 have another option. They will be able to buy a catastrophic health plan through their state's exchange at a price below that of the least expensive plan available for adults age 30 and older, the so-called bronze plan sold on each exchange, which covers 60% of medical costs on average. While staying on their parents' insurance plan or buying a catastrophic plan provides young adults alternatives to the extremes of either buying full health insurance coverage or refusing to get any coverage at all, these alternatives also undermine the overall strength of Obamacare. The new healthcare system will be weakened significantly if the young and healthy invincibles are allowed to escape making financial contributions into the new system, as their participation is needed to strengthen the insurance risk pool for all Americans. How will I prove that I have health insurance? The IRS has yet to announce guidelines, but it has made indications that proving health insurance coverage will probably follow the current procedure, which is used to report investment income to the government. If your employer provides your health insurance, the company will likely be required to provide paperwork to the IRS stating that fact. The same procedure would apply if you hold a private insurance policy, except your insurer would have to report your coverage. If you happen to have coverage through Medicaid, Medicare, or a state's health exchange, that fact will automatically be reported to the IRS. Chapter 6, The Expansion of Medicaid. In its efforts to decrease the number of uninsured Americans, Obamacare wields a coercive stick called the individual mandate, making it a legal requirement for every American to get health insurance or pay a fine. It then offers up three carrots that help soften the blow: the expansion of Medicaid, the creation of health insurance exchanges, and financial incentives for small businesses. In this chapter, we focus on Medicaid's expansion. In the chapters that follow, we discuss the other carrots in turn. To appreciate the scope of the Medicaid expansion planned under Obamacare, let's step back and look at Medicaid as it exists today. Created in 1965, the Medicaid program provides health insurance for the poorest Americans and children who would otherwise have none. It's managed jointly by the states and the federal government, with each paying a share of the costs. The states run the program on a day-to-day basis, but the federal government controls how it functions and determines, with some important limits on its power, who can enroll. Who is eligible for Medicaid today? States must let people into the program who have incomes that fall below minimum levels. Pregnant women and young children can enroll in Medicaid if their household income level is below 133% of the federal poverty line. The threshold drops to 100% FPL for school-age children. The elderly and disabled also may enroll, but the threshold is again lower, 75% FPL. For working parents, it drops all the way down to 25% FPL. As of mid-2012, the federal government does not require that the states let childless adults into the program. Keep in mind that these are the minimum federal eligibility thresholds. States can and often do increase them, so more citizens can enroll in Medicaid. In some cases, they receive federal matching funds for letting more people in. But in others, they are on their own and must pay the full amount for the coverage of the extra people they let in. Obamacare's intention was to set the income threshold for all these groups at 133% of the federal poverty level, including childless adults. That is why 26 states filed a lawsuit against the law, with the Supreme Court eventually ruling in their favor, saying that the federal government could not put a gun to the head of the states and force them to increase Medicaid enrollment in this way. The court said the decision to expand enrollment was up to the states, not Washington. The Supreme Court's decision regarding Medicaid's expansion, which significantly weakens but does not kill Obamacare, was applauded by critics of the law, including many Republican governors. Chris Christie of New Jersey was pleased, telling a receptive audience at the Brookings Institution, "I was glad that the Supreme Court ruled that extortion is still illegal. That's a relief. Because Obamacare on Medicaid to the states was extortion. It essentially said you expand your program to where we tell you, and if you don't, we're taking all the rest of your money away." Believing that the sovereignty of individual states needs to be respected more than it currently is, Governor Rick Perry of Texas was just as happy to have more flexibility to manage Medicaid without Washington's interference. He went further than Christie, blasting the weakness of the Medicaid program itself and blaming its deficiencies on decades of mismanagement by the federal government. "Medicaid is a system of inflexible mandates, one-size-fits-all requirements, and wasteful bureaucratic inefficiencies," wrote Perry in a letter to Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. Later, he told Fox News, "Medicaid is a failed program. To expand this program is not unlike adding 1,000 people to the Titanic." As colorful as that metaphor is, history suggests Medicaid will survive. All the evidence we have of the life cycle of big federal entitlement programs is that they continue to grow and suck up more taxpayer dollars. Enjoying special political protection because so many voters rely on the benefits they provide, none of them have thus far disappeared, and Medicaid is a long way from sinking under its own weight, with the federal government standing ready to keep it afloat even as it takes on water. The current Medicaid landscape, an uneven playing field. Because of flexibility in the law, some states allow more people into Medicaid than they are required to by the federal government, while others take a harder line and maintain narrow eligibility requirements, restricting the number of enrollees to a select few. A person's eligibility for Medicaid therefore depends very much on where he or she lives. If you're a working parent and want to get Medicaid coverage today, your greatest chance of success is in Minnesota, where the income threshold is the highest in the United States. Put another way, Minnesota, with its average income threshold at 275% of the federal poverty level, lets a bigger share of its working parent population into Medicaid than any other state in the country. What does this mean in 2010 dollars? Working parents in Minnesota can receive Medicaid benefits if their income is below $60,638, which is equal to 275% of the poverty level for a family of four. This is far more generous than Alabama, where working parents can receive Medicaid benefits only if their income level is below $5,513, which is equal to 25% of the poverty level. Minnesota's door into Medicaid is thus a startling 11 times more open to working parents than is Alabama's. Obamacare levels the playing field. Under Obamacare, the confusing, inconsistent, and arguably unfair mishmash of Medicaid income eligibility levels across the nation disappears and is replaced by a single standard, at least for those states that agree to participate in the law's planned expansion of the program. As we've discussed, the Supreme Court in June 2012 struck down an important coercive provision of Obamacare, which said that if a state decided not to expand the number of Medicaid enrollees as the law required, then it would risk losing all of its federal support for the program. With this part of the law now null and void, states are free to reject Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid without losing any of their federal support. A large amount of money was at stake, as Washington paid, on average, 57% of the cost of Medicaid in each state. At the time this book was sent to press, it was still not clear how many states would agree to participate in the expansion of Medicaid, but as many as 10 could decide to opt out. Texas, Florida, Mississippi, Virginia, and South Carolina have already indicated they are leaning toward non-participation, and others, especially those with Republican governors, may join them. For the 40 or more states who do decide to increase their Medicaid rolls under Obamacare's auspices, the expansion will set the Medicaid enrollment threshold at 133% of the federal poverty level for all groups, raising the current level for school-age children from 100% FPL, the elderly disabled from 75% FPL, and working parents from 25% FPL. Childless adults, who the federal government said could be left out of the program altogether in the past, now must receive full admittance as long as their income is below 133% FPL. What does this mean? For one thing, there will no longer be any differences in eligibility requirements between two states like Minnesota and Alabama, both which will now have the same income threshold for all Americans under age 65. Senior citizens, of course, will continue to primarily rely on Medicare for their health insurance. How will Americans be able to find out whether they qualify for Medicaid under the new rules? That will be easy. All they will have to do is contact their state's health insurance exchange, which will be tasked with determining every American's eligibility for government assistance, whether for Medicaid or for subsidies to help buy insurance through an exchange. Medicaid expansion will affect each state differently. The impact of Obamacare on each state will depend in large part on what the state's Medicaid income eligibility levels were before the new legislation was passed. For instance, Minnesota will be affected less than many other states because its annual income thresholds are already more than double those that will be required by Obamacare. Still, even Minnesota will likely see increased enrollment in Medicaid. Why? Because the individual mandate will undoubtedly compel some people to sign up for the program who were already eligible but did not enroll, whether out of ignorance or indifference. Enrollment will also dramatically increase because of those who are now, for the first time, permitted to enroll in Medicaid, even in a state like Minnesota, which already has very loose eligibility requirements. Like every other state, it will now have a flood of adults without children signing up for Medicaid benefits. New enrollees will come into Medicaid across the country because of this provision, again, assuming the state agrees to participate in Obamacare's expansion of the program. At the other end of the impact spectrum is Alabama, which will be affected by Obamacare more than any other state if it agrees to participate in the expansion. Medicaid enrollment in this state will likely increase for the same reasons it will increase in Minnesota, but in Alabama, there is a much bigger factor at play. Because its Medicaid income eligibility levels are currently very narrow, enrollment in the program will dramatically increase under Obamacare. Prior to Obamacare, a working parent in Alabama had to make less than $5,513, 25% of the poverty level, to qualify for Medicaid. When Medicaid is expanded in 2014, the same working parent could make as much as $29,327, 133% of the poverty line for a family of four, and still get in. That's almost a six-fold increase in the income eligibility level. Minnesota and Alabama are polar opposites, used here to illustrate the impact of Obamacare on the states. All states that agree to participate will be affected by Medicaid's expansion to some degree that falls between these extreme cases, and some will obviously benefit more than others in terms of decreasing the number of uninsured within their borders. We've talked at length about all the new people who will be eligible for Medicaid. Ironically, some of the program's current enrollees will actually lose their eligibility under Obamacare. For instance, people currently in Minnesota's Medicaid program who earn above the 133% federal poverty line will be forced to move to the state's health exchange. When they do, they will receive a generous federal subsidy to buy their insurance, but their new coverage will cost them some money out of pocket, and this amount, whatever it is, will be higher than what they pay for Medicaid, which is free to its enrollees. Who pays for Medicaid's expansion? According to the Congressional Budget Office, roughly 15 million more people will sign up for Medicaid by 2019 as a result of Obamacare. This estimate assumes the participation of all 50 states in the country, plus the District of Columbia. After the Supreme Court ruling, states are now free to opt out of the expansion of Medicaid without incurring a financial penalty. Because of this, some states will not participate, but the exact number that will opt out is unknown. Whether the number of new Medicaid enrollees is 15 million or something lower, the actual expansion will probably fall 10 to 20% below this prediction for the whole country. Who will pay to provide health care for all of these people? Most of it will be funded by the federal government, with individual states eventually contributing a small share to cover new people entering the program. States like Alabama, assuming it agrees to participate in the expansion, that had income thresholds in Medicaid far below 133% of the poverty level before Obamacare, will benefit most from the federal funding. A huge swath of the uninsured in this state will finally get health care coverage, and the federal government, in other words, the American taxpayer, will pay nearly all of the Medicaid costs of these newly insured. Not a bad deal if you live on a low income in Alabama. Here's how it will work. When the doors to Medicaid open wide in 2014, all of the new people who sign up above the federal government's old income thresholds will be classified as newly eligible. The federal government will pay to cover these newcomers according to a phased-in payment schedule. In the first 3 years of Obamacare, the federal government will pay for 100% of all the newly eligible people in Medicaid, with the level reduced to 90% by 2020. These levels of financial support for the states are much higher than the current contribution the federal government makes to each state to support Medicaid. As it currently stands, the states only get between 50 to 75% of their Medicaid costs covered by the federal government. Levels vary based on a state's wealth. Today, on average, the federal government picks up 57% of the cost of Medicaid for each state. Against this established standard, the increased funding for Medicaid under Obamacare is a great deal for the states, at least in the short term. But states like Texas and Florida are leaning toward not participating in the program's expansion out of worry that the large federal contribution will drop significantly after 2020, creating a ticking time bomb that might eventually blow up their already strained budgets. Right now, there are no guarantees in the law that the Obamacare level of federal support for new eligibles will be maintained. So in this sense, the fear is reasonable. States considering opting out of Medicaid's expansion are also worried about a flood of so-called old eligibles to the program. These are the many individuals who could have signed up for Medicaid without Obamacare's eligibility changes, but did not do so out of indifference or ignorance. The financial burden for states from these old eligibles will be heavier than for new eligibles, since the federal government will pay for them under the old formula, which covers only 57% of their cost on average. How many old eligibles will sign up to Medicaid? A scholarly article in the New England Journal of Medicine by Ben Summers and Arnold Epstein estimates that only 62% of those eligible for Medicaid today have actually enrolled in the program. In Texas and Florida, the participation rates are even lower, at 44% and 48% respectively. The authors of the analysis estimate that 9 million Americans across the country are currently not receiving Medicaid, but could if they would simply sign up for it. It's anyone's guess how many of these 9 million will sign up for Medicaid because of Obamacare. But if about half do, that will mean 4 or 5 million more enrollees for the states to absorb, enrollees that will only have 57% of their cost funded from Washington and not the 93% funding amount promised for new eligibles. State governors who have opposed the expansion of Medicaid have good reason to worry. Some states, like California, have already expanded the programs, permitting new people to come in under the new Obamacare eligibility thresholds that take effect in 2014. It has added 400,000 uninsured residents to its Medicaid program, a level it expects to rise to 500,000 within 2 years. This is a generous policy, but it is made in a state where the Medicaid reimbursement rates to doctors ranks 47th out of 50 states in the country. The door for new enrollees is wide open in California, but the quality of its program is hurt by shifting the financial burden onto the shoulders of doctors, many of whom simply refuse to see Medicaid patients. When doctors are shortchanged, Medicaid patients are ultimately hurt because they have difficulty finding a doctor who will care for them and, if they are fortunate enough to find one, often experience lengthy waiting times and have to travel long distances to get the care they need. As Nina Outurenko, an expert on health policy at the Heritage Foundation, put it, with more people on Medicaid, states will have to continue to ratchet down payments and limit services. Seeing this problem, the federal government has increased payment rates to primary care doctors who take Medicaid patients to the higher Medicare level but the increase is only temporary and will expire at the end of 2014. Seen in this light, the expansion of Medicaid will not be smooth sailing. It will increase the financial burden of states and likely hurt the quality of the program as they scramble to cut costs and benefits to let the air out of bloated budgets. As the old saying in economics goes, there is no such thing as a free lunch. The money to pay for the expansion will have to come from somewhere. If a state like Texas is worried about new financial burdens caused by the expansion of the program, some states could save some amount of money from the changes in eligibility. Minnesota, for instance, currently permits working families to enroll in Medicaid if their income is lower than 275% of the federal poverty line. Under Obamacare, the threshold will be pushed down to 133%. The number of working families on Medicaid in Minnesota is thus likely to drop significantly, with those who lose their eligibility given subsidies to buy health insurance on the state's new exchange. Since the federal government pays for the entire cost of the subsidies given out to individuals who buy health insurance through the exchanges, Minnesota will save some money because of this change. Its total cost for Medicaid, however, might stay the same or even go up, because childless adults will now be added to the program's rolls within the state, and the addition of these individuals could more than offset those who moved from Medicaid to a subsidized exchange. Remember the Cornhusker kickback? One of the biggest controversies during the national debate over Obamacare involved the backroom deal between Senator Ben Nelson and the Democratic leadership in the Senate. In return for his vote in favor of the health care reform legislation proposed by his party, Nelson's home state of Nebraska was promised special treatment, which significantly lowered the amount it had to pay to cover newly eligible Medicaid enrollees. When news of the deal became public, it triggered widespread outrage, with the loudest protests coming from Arnold Schwarzenegger, the only Republican governor to support Obamacare. He demanded that California and every other state in the country get the same deal given to Nebraska. In the end, that's what happened, diffusing the anger over the Cornhusker kickback, but increasing the cost of Obamacare at the federal level. Strengthening Medicaid for the Obamacare expansion. Obamacare includes a number of key provisions that will help strengthen Medicaid before and during its dramatic expansion. Increased Medicaid payment rates. One of the biggest problems with Medicaid over the years has been the difficulty many recipients have had finding doctors to take them on as patients. Obamacare tries to fix this problem by increasing Medicaid payment rates for primary care doctors, including those in family, general internal, and pediatric medicine. The new rates will be raised to Medicare levels in 2014 and expire at the end of that year. More funding for Children's Insurance Health Program, CHIP. Under Obamacare, each state will receive a 23% increase in their CHIP funding, up to a ceiling of 100%. Since the federal government already covers 65% or more of CHIP in most states, the program will largely be paid for in full by the federal government in 2014 and after. In addition, children who are excluded from CHIP because of enrollment limits will be able to get tax credits for insurance obtained through their state's healthcare exchange. Chapter 7. Health Insurance Exchanges. In the last chapter, we discussed the expansion of Medicaid. Now we move on to Obamacare's second big carrot, health insurance exchanges in every state. The collective importance of the exchanges cannot be overstated, as they will function as the brain of the new healthcare system, with direct links connecting them to Medicaid and the private insurance market. Over time, they will probably begin to encroach on employer-based insurance, starting with small businesses and eventually affecting businesses of all sizes. The future of the new healthcare law will depend very much on the exchanges. If they fail, Obamacare will likely fail with them. If they succeed, healthcare in the United States will be transformed, and a decade or more down the road, the current employer-based system could be largely replaced by government-controlled, exchange-based insurance. What is a health insurance exchange? Simply put, a health insurance exchange is a marketplace, very much like your neighborhood supermarket. When you need groceries, you visit your store to buy the products you need based on the benefits they offer you relative to their price. A health insurance exchange works the same way, except the product isn't milk or cereal, but health insurance. The exchanges at the heart of Obamacare, referred to officially in the legislation as the American Health Benefit Exchanges, differ, however, from your neighborhood supermarket in a few important ways. For one thing, they're government-regulated, meaning that the insurance sold to consumers has to meet specific quality standards. For another, some of the people who shop at the exchange will be provided money by the government to reduce the price they pay for insurance. Each state must have an exchange because of a provision of the law which says that if any state refuses to create one for its residents by 2014, some have already threatened non-compliance, the federal government will create and manage it for them. Given the loud opposition from many states, fueled mostly by their dissatisfaction with the expansion of Medicaid, federally run exchanges are likely in some states. As of mid-2013, only 17 states and the District of Columbia have announced plans to create their own exchanges. Another 26 have opted to let the federal government run them. 7 will partner with the federal government on the exchanges. Alaska Governor Sean Parnell, whose state will not create its own exchange, explained his decision by saying, "Allocating state dollars and personnel to design and implement an exchange is the most expensive option." Will exchanges improve the healthcare system? If you didn't hear much about the health insurance exchanges in the debate over Obamacare, there's a reason. Compared to other parts of the new law, they are free of controversy. Conservatives like that they are competitive marketplaces, while liberals like the way they protect consumers and subsidize their purchases. Enjoying support from many on both sides of the political fence, the exchanges are expected to improve the current system in a number of ways. Increased choice. Just as multiple brands of cereal can be found in an aisle of the supermarket, multiple health insurance plans will be housed in each exchange, where consumers will be able to easily compare plans to one another based on their price and quality. Standardization. Plans sold through the exchange by different insurance companies must contain identical levels of benefits at specific tiers of coverage, so consumers can make apples-to-apples comparisons between the plans. Consumer protection. Consumers will have confidence that they are not being sold an inferior policy because each plan must cover essential health benefits. Economies of scale. Because the exchanges will be places where hundreds of thousands, and in some case millions, of consumers shop, they will foster healthy competition among insurance companies. As a consequence, prices should come down as quality goes up. As vocal as Republicans have been in criticizing Obamacare, former U.S. Senator Bill Frist, a heart transplant surgeon and party elder who once served as majority leader of the U.S. Senate, is not a knee-jerk opponent of the new law. He is a big supporter of the exchanges and wrote an editorial in their favor, saying, "Originally a Republican idea, the state insurance exchanges mandated under the Affordable Care Act, ACA, will offer a menu of private insurance plans to pick and choose from, all with a required set of minimum benefits to those without employer-sponsored health insurance. State exchanges are the solution, wrote Frist. They represent the Federalist ideal of states as laboratories for democracy. We are seeing 50 states, each designing a model that is right for them, empowered to take into account their individual cultures, politics, economies, and demographics. While much planning has yet to be done, we are already seeing a huge range in state models. I love the diversity and the innovation. Frist may be right to be enthusiastic about the exchanges. Right now, insurers spend an estimated $25 billion a year on marketing and distribution of their insurance policies, a significant amount of which can be saved by automating the process with an internet portal. Americans are accustomed to buying all types of products over the internet, from cars to books to airplane tickets. Health insurance, however, has been a laggard in this regard. According to Pricewaterhouse, only about 5% of health insurance policies are currently bought online. When the Obamacare health exchanges begin to operate, this number will rise dramatically, empowering buyers and sellers of insurance alike. You'll be able to shop for health insurance in your state's exchange by visiting the government office that manages it. If you prefer, you can buy an insurance plan over the phone via a toll-free number or through the exchange's website. Most sales will flow through this convenient portal. The goal is to make the whole shopping and buying process as easy as possible for the consumer. As Peter Lee, the head of the new California Health Exchange, put it, buying health insurance should now become as easy as buying a book on Amazon. If it suits a state's needs, it may create multiple exchanges within its borders, as long as each one serves a distinct geographic area within the state. Heavily populated states like California, for instance, could create one exchange to serve the northern part of its geography and another to serve the southern part. On the other end of the spectrum, less populated states will be able to form a regional health insurance exchange with neighboring states, so that Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, and Oregon could, if they choose, form a single Pacific exchange to increase risk pools and better serve their residents. What about a single national exchange? You might be wondering, why not just create a single health insurance exchange that would serve the entire country? Such an exchange would make it possible to buy health insurance across state lines, something which is not legally permitted today. Critics of Obamacare strongly support interstate commerce of this kind. They argue that one of the ways to bring down healthcare costs is to make health insurance more competitive by allowing a person in New Jersey, for instance, to buy a policy from an insurance company in Nevada. A national exchange would seem to be both intrinsically feasible and politically viable. Appearances can be deceiving, however. If we go back to the presidential campaign of 2008, then-candidate Barack Obama actually promised to create a single national health insurance exchange. But once he entered office, the widespread fears that his reform package represented a government takeover of the healthcare system pushed him away from that idea. In the end, a national exchange became untenable. That may not have been a bad outcome for the country. After all, the functional knowledge needed to regulate health insurance currently resides at the state level. Each has its own rules and mandates governing the sale of health insurance. It's probably sensible to leverage this expertise where it exists, rather than try to reinvent the wheel by replacing it with a new federal bureaucracy that would have no experience doing the same tasks. A single national exchange can always be created at a later date if needed. Massachusetts Health Connector. For a real-world example of what a health insurance exchange looks like, visit the Massachusetts Health Connector website at www.mahealthconnector.org. The state's healthcare system, sometimes referred to as Romney Care for former Governor Mitt Romney, who signed the law that created it in 2006, is a working prototype for the Obamacare exchanges that all Americans will see in their states in 2014. In the Massachusetts exchange, the state government acts as the buyer of health insurance from 5 approved insurance providers. It negotiates prices and benefits for various tiers of coverage to help get the best deal for its residents, and only those plans that receive its stamp of approval are made available for purchase. The Obamacare exchanges will work in much the same way, although each state will enjoy a certain amount of flexibility in determining its own management approach. Besides Massachusetts, there is only one other health insurance exchange operating in the United States right now, a much smaller one in Utah that sells insurance to small businesses. The Utah exchange is more open than the connector in Massachusetts, allowing a wide range of insurance companies to sell policies directly to buyers and letting free market forces set prices. The exchanges created by Obamacare that began operating in 2014 will be able to choose either of these management philosophies or something in between. In California, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger set in motion the process of creating that state's exchange in 2010. Much to the delight of President Obama, he did so using the Massachusetts model as a template, making it clear that the state government in Sacramento would be a vigilant gatekeeper and manager of its exchange with tight controls. Obamacare's template, the Massachusetts example. Like Obamacare, the Massachusetts healthcare system is powered by an individual mandate, which compels participation in the system through the threat of a financial penalty, and is built around a heavily subsidized exchange where regulated insurance plans can be bought at affordable prices. The question naturally arises, how has the Massachusetts system worked since its creation? The answer will give us some indication about how Obamacare would perform if it was fully implemented. According to an in-depth study by the conservative Beacon Hill Institute, Romney Care has hurt the state significantly by costing it almost 20,000 jobs, driving up health insurance costs by more than $4 billion, lowering disposable income per household by almost $400. On the positive side, Massachusetts now has the highest level of health care coverage in the country, with only about 3% of its population uninsured. Most of the newly insured have received coverage through subsidies, and about half pay nothing at all for their insurance, leaving state taxpayers to pick up the bill. Obamacare is likely to do much the same on a national scale. Despite Romney Care's promises to bring down health care costs, they were eerily similar to Obamacare's promises back in 2008. The typical family of four in Massachusetts now pays the highest health insurance premiums in the country, according to the Commonwealth Fund, a nonprofit healthcare foundation. If there is a lesson to be learned from the Massachusetts example, it appears to be that it will be very costly to implement a similar system across the entire United States, as it will likely lead to more expensive health insurance, fewer jobs, and a greater financial burden for taxpayers. The number of uninsured Americans will fall dramatically, but the price for this expansion of health care coverage will put another blot on the nation's already ugly balance sheet. The Massachusetts healthcare system is, in short, a case study that makes a persuasive argument that Obamacare may, on the whole, reduce the number of uninsured residents, but at a significant cost to American taxpayers and insurance policyholders. Are exchanges really necessary? In striving to decrease the uninsured population, Obamacare dramatically expands Medicaid, and in the process, gives health insurance to 15 million people at no direct cost to them. This figure assumes all states participate in the expansion of the program. But as bold and sweeping as that action is, it still would leave more than 20 million Americans without health insurance in 2019. The authors of Obamacare turned to health insurance exchanges as the means to expand coverage to this portion of the uninsured population, because they saw that the exchange in Massachusetts had helped that state secure health insurance for 97% of its residents. Taking something that has worked within one state and spreading it to other states is not a new idea. Back in the 1930s, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis famously called the states the great laboratories of democracy. But rarely has a program of such importance been expanded to the entire country in the way the Obamacare exchanges promised to do. By 2019, roughly 25 million people are expected to use the exchanges to obtain quality coverage at an affordable cost. This includes 16 million people who would otherwise be uninsured, plus an additional 9 million Americans from the private and employer-based insurance markets who will be attracted by the low cost and high value of exchange insurance plans. Eligibility to use the exchanges. Who exactly will be eligible to buy health insurance on the exchanges? Pretty much every American will be allowed into the exchange in their state when they want to buy insurance for themselves, but there are some additional rules governing eligibility. Illegal aliens excluded. Only U.S. citizens and legal immigrants who are not incarcerated will be able to use the exchanges. Legal immigrants are not eligible for Medicaid benefits during their first 5 years in the United States, but those who would have qualified for the program if they were here long enough will be able to receive government financial assistance if they want to buy insurance through the exchange while they wait to get into Medicaid. Employees who have poor coverage. The exchanges were created mostly with the private health insurance market in mind, to help reduce the cost for single individuals and families trying to buy coverage on their own. The exchanges, however, are also open to workers whose employers offer them health insurance that does not cover at least 60% of their medical costs, or if the employee's share of premiums exceeds 9.5% of their wages. Small businesses. Companies with up to 100 employees may buy health insurance for their employees through an exchange. The Exchange for Businesses, called the Small Business Health Options Program, or SHOP, will be kept separate from those for individuals in each state. Beginning in 2017, states will be allowed, if they choose, to let companies with more than 100 employees buy insurance through the exchanges. There's a good reason to keep big businesses out of the exchanges during the initial phase-in period. They tend to have a relatively large share of older, less healthy employees enrolled in their insurance plans. If members of this higher-risk group were permitted to immediately enter the exchanges, they could push the price of premiums upward by their presence and squeeze out smaller businesses trying to buy affordable insurance. Will large businesses use the exchanges if they are eventually allowed into them? The answer will depend on how well the exchanges function between 2014 and 2017. If they create a marketplace where prices are low, companies of all sizes will be attracted to them, especially if they can also escape the administrative burden of managing health care for their employees by buying insurance from an exchange. 4 standardized plans: Bronze, Silver, Gold, and Platinum. Buying a health insurance plan that meets all your needs is not an easy task. For one thing, it's often hard to know the value of what you're buying. With so many different parts of insurance coverage and so much fine print, much of it written in hard-to-understand legalese, it's not uncommon to discover that your insurance doesn't cover a condition that you thought it did. And this discovery usually happens right when you need the coverage in question. One of the biggest benefits of the exchanges is that they will cut through this complexity and simplify the decision-making process for those who go to buy health insurance. Each state's exchange will be required to offer 4 standardized insurance plans, which collectively will provide a range of coverage, low to high. These plans will be designated bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, with each providing a successively higher amount of coverage. The quality of these plans should also be high, as each one, regardless of the amount of coverage it offers, will be required to include so-called essential health benefits. All health insurance plans sold outside the exchanges in the individual and small group market will be required to do the same, raising the quality of health insurance everywhere in the United States. What exactly are essential health benefits? In November 2012, the Department of Health and Human Services released a list of the broad areas that will be part of the essential health benefits. By the time the exchanges open in 2014, HHS will have established more details of the health benefits list that will comprise a baseline level of coverage that all plans sold on and off an exchange must have. Generally speaking, these benefits will be comparable to what can be found in a typical employer-based plan today. After this minimum level of benefits is